CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
I'm like, no, not one of them know how to cook anything. They couldn't even cook a salad.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And Barrett Sher.
Hi.
And today we have a very special guest. It is the director and co-writer of a movie called Boiling Point, Philip Barantini. The movie comes out in theaters November 19th and digital and on demand November 23rd. Philip, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, guys. Thanks for having me.
A lot of people who watch this movie will know going in that this is a movie shot entirely in one take.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't seen this since a movie called Victoria that came out.
Yeah, great movie.
It is a great movie. And I'm always amazed at the kind of, the work that has to go into this type of thing. So since you're the co-writer of this movie, how early in the process of writing the screenplay did you realize this was going to be done in one take?
Oh, it was like before we even decided to write it as a feature. We shot a short in 2018, and that was all one take. It was 20 minutes, and it was almost like a proof of concept. Really, I wanted to set something in that world for a long time, because I actually worked as a chef. I was an actor for 25 years, but during that time, I needed to make some money, and a lot of resting happens when you're an actor, especially when you're not, you're not as successful as you'd hoped when you began your career.
Right.
So I started working in kitchens as a chef, and I worked from the bottom, worked up my way up to the top, became a head chef. I was a head chef for 2 years, so I was in kitchens for 12 years overall. And during that time, I was like, wow, this world is just nuts. It's ripe for drama and, everything that's in the movie is something that I've, personally witnessed or experienced myself. And so when we sort of decided to do the short, and, the decision to do it in one take was quite an early thing, really. I sort of wanted to immerse the audience and make it feel quite tense and sort of erratic, and almost like the audience go on this journey. So we decided to do the short in one take, and then when the short did really well in the festival circuit and it was nominated for a British Independent Film Award for best short film and stuff like that. So it was like, okay, let's talk about the feature. And then it was never really a case of any discussion, really. It was always going to be one take, but the obviously there was a lot of sort of technical things that go with that. You need to make sure that we can definitely shoot it in one take with the equipment that we wanted to use, which was not just a sort of digital camera, but like a proper digital film camera, like like an Arri Alexa, whatever, for example, which we tried, but we couldn't use the Arri Alexa because it's the memory card wouldn't have sustained an hour and a half. So we had to find a camera that was able to do that. And so we did a lot of research, and we found the Sony Venice camera, which is it's an incredible piece of kit. First of all, we found out that you could live swap SD cards.
Oh, wow.
Oh, really?
Just like, okay, this is just, this is exactly what we need. It's almost like it was made for one take movies. And the second thing about it is it has a mode where it's called the Rialto mode, where you can basically separate the body of the camera from the sensor and the lens. So the sensor and the lens. And so that it, so for us, it was, we were able to put the camera body on the back of an Easy Rig, which is like a, for people who don't know, it's like a It's a, like a vest that the cinematographer or the camera operator puts on, and it's got like a bar that goes over his head or her mm-hmm. head, and the sort of lens was able to sort of, you know, we were supposed to distribute the weight, so the body of the camera was on, was attached to his back, and then the lens was able to go on the front, so it was like quite agile and nimble. He was able to sustain an hour and a half, or you know, however long. We didn't have a time cap on it or anything like that, so you know, it was that was the challenges really. And in terms of writing the script, the first thing that we had to do was make sure that we had the right location, because you know, we when we did the short, we wrote the script, and then we had to find the location that matched. And luckily we did. It was a catering college in Manchester, England. But but with the feature, we were like, we don't want to go through that bother again and try and find, because I wanted a different location that was, you know, as it is in the movie, it's open plan, and you know, you can see the kitchen from anywhere in the restaurant. So yeah, it was a huge challenge. I can't even remember what the question was now. I've just gone off on an absolute tangent.
Oh, you answered it, and you answered, I think, one of my other questions too. I love it when directors go off and just keep talking, because you know, I'm fascinated by the process. Obviously, you had to rehearse this quite a bit, but I mean, not only do the actors have to rehearse it, but you have to figure out where all the crew's going to be and everything during certain things. So like, how long of a process was that? Did you have enough time to just get everybody together and say, this is where you're going to be, and then you're going to be here for a long time, and then, you know, so on and so forth?
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, finding that location was key, because we needed somewhere that was going to be able to house everybody who's not on camera, as well as everybody that is on camera. Because, you know, when you're doing, you know, we didn't want to, the camera wasn't able to have a wire attached to it, to the monitors. So it, you know, to enable the sort of I can't think of the name off my head now. So, you know, the connection, basically the digital connection between the camera and the monitors, you know, if the camera goes a certain distance away, then we're going to lose picture. So we had to make sure that we had, you know, the right thing for that. But we built two false walls in the restaurant to enable myself and all the crew to hide behind during the take, because one of the sound mixers was hidden behind a wall at the front of the restaurant. And then when you go into the second room in the restaurant where the sort of racist table is,
right,
the wall to the next to them is a completely false wall. And behind there is about 50 crew members all just squashed in, oh, no. All squashed around like three monitors, just watching it all unfold, you know?
There's one shot in here. I think for most viewers, it'll probably read as just as an innocuous part of the movie. I mean, there's not really an innocuous part of the movie, but I'm just saying that there's a part where Stephen Graham, who plays your main character, Andy, or I guess one of the big characters in the movie.
Yeah.
He goes to talk to Alistair, who's played by Jason Fleming. Mm-hmm. He goes over to talk to him at their table, but you still have the shot lined up where you see the restaurant and all of the activity behind it going on for however long that is. I should have whipped out a phone and started timing how long this was, but you can see, I mean, Stephen Graham comes from the kitchen and he's talking to his other two chefs and then goes to that table. He delivers the food.
Right.
They have to continue like being back there, quote unquote, making food, I guess, while he's talking way far away on the other end of the restaurant. Meanwhile, you have everybody on the side having to do that. The diners have to dine. All this stuff has to happen for minutes on end. Like, is there sort of a background script for a lot of these people, or did they just kind of do what they felt like they needed to do? I mean, I imagine you'd have to map it out pretty carefully, but.
Yeah, we did. But at the same time, you know, I sort of especially for the kitchen team and the bar staff and any of the waiting staff as well. I just sort of gave them a job that lasted at least 15 minutes. And I just said, look, you're not really, you are, and I'm so glad you've brought this up because it's, you know, it's amazing. You know, and I knew people would spot it, you know, that they were in the background looking like they were working and on these dishes. So we had a lot of plates that were already plated up with food hidden in the fridges underneath and hidden in the ovens that were not switched on. So every so often I'd say, like, just pull a plate up and just, you know, fiddle with it. And then one of the, you know, call the waiting staff over as if you're in a real restaurant and, you know, just get them to, and then I'd just say to the waiting staff, just go and take it to a table. And then the customers, I'd say, don't eat the food because it's been sat there for about 3 hours. But, you know, at least mime that you're about to eat it or something like that. And then again with the bar staff, I was like, you know, just make some drinks, just fake making some drinks, or when in doubt, clean some glasses.
Right.
You know, kind of
right.
Like a real restaurant, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It'll
yeah.
look fake like you're it. Busy if you're not. That's what's beautiful. And I'm so glad that you said that up front, is that you had such experience in the restaurant industry, because from my limited experience of this, you touch on every facet of this, from the dishwasher to the pastry chef to the prep to the sous chef to the executive chef. And what a weird little family that is, right?
Oh, it's exactly what it is. It's a family, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I love how you had the waiter with the second job trying to get people to come to his
DJ night. Yeah. That's literally based on someone that I worked with. He was, you know, and that was one of the lines in the movies. I'm a DJ moonlighting as a waiter. And he used to say that to all the customers. He'd be trying to get customers into his gig, like, you know, after work. It was, he was like, I'm not going to be doing this forever. I'm a DJ, you know, I'm going to be famous. I'm going to be on stage.
Well, look at you, right? I mean, you turned into this feature director after your tryst in the restaurant.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. There is hope for everybody. But yeah, but going back to the family thing, yeah, it totally is a family, because I was saying to somebody earlier that, you know, when you're working in kitchens or in restaurants, you generally spend more time with the people that you're working with than you do with your family, and that is not a good thing, right? In a way, and it touches upon it in the movie with Steven's character. You know, at the beginning he's left, you know, he's just left his girlfriend. He's been kicked out, and it's, you know, because of what he's putting his attention on and what he's going through, you know. But it is a family dynamic, dysfunctional family dynamic, but yeah.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. For sure. Right. Everybody, nobody's perfect in this film. Like, even you could say that really kind of the hero is, I guess, Carly's like the chef de cuisine or something like that. Right.
Yeah.
Where she kind of keeps everything together, but then she has that delightfully awful, just berating of the front of the house manager. And it just shows you how dysfunctional this whole thing can be, even with somebody that's supposed to be holding everyone together, right?
Yeah. And then, you know, you it's like with your siblings or your parents, you have a blowout and you argue, and then, you know, 10 minutes later, you're like, yeah, sorry about that. Or, you know, it's completely back to normal again, you know?
Yeah.
Like she says, you know, can we go for a drink later and we can talk about it? It's like, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still feeling raw about it, but all right.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned drink, no problem.
You're right. Talk about your casting here, because a lot of people know Stephen Graham. A lot of people probably seen Jason Fleming in a million things. Yep. But yeah, you have a really well-rounded cast. Are a lot of these people like big time stage actors in addition to being screen actors, or were they mostly stage or whatever? I know I've seen Vinette Robinson before.
Yeah.
She was on Sherlock for a few episodes. Yep. I remember.
That's right, yeah.
And she's incredible. I want to see more of her. Just kind of talk about, how you got involved with this cast.
So, I wanted to use some of them from the short film, so we brought some of them back, and not in the same roles really, we brought them back in different roles. And yeah, I just wanted them to be, because I knew they were great actors, but it's a funny, you know, it's a funny game, and the producers wanted bigger names in certain roles. So people who were in the short were in one specific role, for example. And then, you know, to bring them back for that same role, which was a much bigger role in obviously a feature film, they wanted slightly more experienced or bigger names. So, but I still wanted to sort of get them in the movie. So there was that side of it. And then the other side was, you know, with Steven's character, in reality, he's the head chef and sort of, you know, part owner of this restaurant. He mm-hmm. would have employed every single member of the kitchen staff personally. You know, so I said to him early on, I was like, this is really important that you put your, you know, 2 pence in here and just go, look, let's cast it together, this kitchen. So I want you to send me suggestions, or, you know, people who you think might be right for it. And Vinette was the first person that he sent. And it was like, oh, wow. Yeah. And I've seen some of her stuff before. And I just was like, yeah, absolutely amazing. Because that role is incredibly important. For his relationship, you know, they're supposed to have known each other for a long, long time, and so I needed somebody who had worked with Steven and who knew Steven, and because Steven is an incredibly passionate actor, and you know, he's on top of his game, and you need to be on top of your game if you're going to go toe to toe with him, because he's on fire, you know, he's like a whirlwind, so you need to be ready for that. So in terms of the rest of the cast. We put out our casting director, Carolyn McLeod. She sent out submissions and stuff, and we had a lot of people come back, because as soon as you get, you know, especially over here in this country, as soon as you say Stephen Graham's in something, every actor wants to be a part of it. So we were so lucky to get like so many submissions, but at the same time, it was difficult to go through them. So you know, because we didn't really have, we had a script, and the dialogue was basically bullet points at this point. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to workshop the script with the actors and to get the naturalistic dialogue. And then we wrote the dialogue from the workshops. But prior to that, with the auditions, I sort of said to the casting director, just get the actors to tell me a story about the worst experience and the best experience they've ever had in a restaurant, whether they've worked in it or just, you know, eating or drank in a bar or whatever. And whilst making a cup of coffee or a cup of tea. That was the task. That's all I said. And you'll be surprised the amount of actors who had rehearsed this story to within an inch of its life. And then they performed it to camera whilst making this, just stirring this empty cup with no liquid in it, you know, and that's not what I asked for. I asked them to just make a real cup of coffee or tea whilst telling me a story off the cuff, you know, just a natural story. And so then we whittled it down to those actors who were just really natural. And then I brought them in to audition them. And I got an actor friend of mine to sort of, I didn't tell them, I told them they knew what role they were coming in for. Say, for example, it was Tony the chef or whatever. They knew that. And so they knew the sort of backstory of the chef, but I didn't tell them what I wanted them to do in the audition. So when they came in, I said to my friend, Robbie, I just whisper in his ear before they come in and say, okay, this, I'm going to set them up with some props, you know, some bowls and some spoons to just mime some stuff. And I said, and I want you to go in there and literally scream at them as if they've just, you know, they're late for work and all this kind of stuff. And some actors just didn't know how to handle that. You know, they were just so like, whoa, they were like, I'm sorry. I was not expecting that. Could we go again? And, you know, we did, obviously I did go again and help, you know, I didn't want to just kick them out the room, but I wanted the people who were able to act spontaneously and just go with it and be like in the moment and just completely be immersive and sort of vulnerable as well. And those are the people that we ultimately chose. And you know, I think it paid off in terms of like the sort of the realism and the sort of you know, the believability of these characters being real. I mean, a lot of people have said to me, "Did you use real chefs?" I'm like, no, not one of them know how to cook anything. They couldn't even cook a salad.
There's a certain type of movement, and you know when you see it. There's a certain type of movement for restaurant staff, from the wait staff all the way, you know, to the prep and the expediters. That is replicated in this. And I have to think that it came from your experience of being in that world.
Yeah. The one thing we didn't have enough of was time. And, you know, I would have loved to have gotten all of the actors and taken them to chef school for a couple of weeks and, you know, and bar school or whatever it may be. But we didn't have enough time, and we shot this on a really low budget, and so the next best thing is exactly what you just said, is have them look and move like chefs or waiting staff, you know. And so we got some real chefs in who were sort of consultants on the movie, because I didn't want to sort of have to do everything. I wanted to focus on the performances and the camera movement and everything else, basically. And so if I could take the chefy side of it out of the equation for myself and give it to a real chef who could then, you know, we work together on it, and I would say, look, I want them to do this, I want them to look like this, or, you know, spoon the butter over the meat at this point or whatever, you know, or turn the fish and stuff like that. They need to look like they know what they're doing, but obviously they don't need to know what they're doing, but it has to look like that. It's like the illusion, you know. So that's what we worked with, and luckily we, you know, all the actors were so on board with it and just so enthusiastic, and you know, it really pays off. And I think, again, that's sort of testament to Steven as well, because he's you know, he comes on set and everybody pays attention, because, you know, like I say, if you're not ready and you're not on form, then you're going to go down. You're literally going to go down. So, yeah.
I suppose the moments where you are following one character in their private moment, mm-hmm. like several, there's several moments in this where you're doing that. Mm. That's where everybody, at least the actors, got to finally just kind of rest a little bit? Or did you have some people who were just like, I've got to stay in character, I'm going to continue pretending to be making food while the camera's away and everything? Or was that meant to be in there so people could say, all right, I can take 5 minutes?
Yeah, I mean, look, I to be honest, like, I, when we were rehearsing, that was the time for me to direct, because with it being a one take, you know, once I call action on the takes, I am literally behind a monitor and unable to do anything, really. And right. it was horrific, actually, mm-hmm. because, mm-hmm. you know, you're just watching it play out and it's like, oh my gosh. And then each point you're like, okay, we got, yeah, that's great, we got that bit. And then, you know, I since recently learned that, and actually we've actually shot hours and hours and hours of behind the scenes footage from the moment we started writing the script to the moment of the shoot. So we're
now
putting,
see this.
We're putting a sort of like a 30-minute documentary together, which will be available soon, I think. But we were out in Zurich Film Festival recently, and mm-hmm. Vinette was there with us, and she and I was like, someone asked the question, you know, what exactly that question, what you just asked, what were you guys doing when the camera wasn't on you? Were you still, you know, pretending to cook in the background or whatever? And she was like, oh God, no. Mm-hmm. Oh no, so Vinette had it, she called it her sort of like, what did she call it? I can't remember now. Basically it was like a go-to book. Basically she'd written all these notes in this book, and she'd hidden it in the fridge underneath, under the counter. And as soon as the camera was off, all the chefs would just surround Vinette and be like, right, what are we doing now? Where are we next? What are we doing next? And then they go back to their moments, you know. It was really funny to realize that they were all, you know, sort of panicking. So I'm sure all that will be on camera in the behind the scenes thing.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
I mean, I gotta say that, you know, while the one take aspect of this movie is something that's, you know, you're always going to be aware of, there are points in the movie where you just kind of forget that it's happening.
Yeah.
Because the scene itself takes control, especially during the scene Barrett's talking about with the, you know, when Vanetta's dressing down the manager, mm-hmm. About not knowing how, you know, lamb is cooked, and that whole thing. And I kept trying to imagine this movie though, without the one take, like it's kind of just it would still be good, but it just doesn't seem, I mean, there's something about cutting during these things that just would make it not special at all. And I don't know what that is. I don't know. I feel like you pulled off a bit of a magic trick here to let people know that first off, this is being done in one take. You're going to forget sometimes that it is being shot in one take, but you can't figure out how it would have been made without it.
Well, yeah, the idea was always, to once we decided we were going to do it in one take, it wasn't because I wanted to show, look how clever we are, you know, like 1917 movies like that, they're fantastic, one take, your Birdman, another one, it's the great movie, for this, it was a case of, you know, when you're working in that environment, it's one take. You can't go back or stop for a minute. You know, it's just constantly moving forward all the time, especially, you know, you've got new customers coming in, you've got to serve the table, and you've got to go over there, and you've got to go over there. So, you know, for me, I wanted the camera to be the audience's eyes and almost the audience be a member of the staff or whatever, you know, and sort of experience it in an immersive way, and, you know, not be able to take your eyes off the screen. And I almost wanted to just, you know, dump the audience in and then pull them back out again an hour and a half later and just be like, whoa, what that, you know, like almost like a, like looking into the, like a Big Brother type vibe, you know, this is what's happening in this world right now. And then, you know, if the camera was to float over to another restaurant, this is what was happening here, you know, that kind of thing. And I just wanted to have that sort of quick slice of life, really.
How many did you end up doing? How many did you attempt before you finally got the right one?
Well, we actually originally gave ourselves 4 nights to shoot it over, and each night we were going to do it twice. Oh. So we would come in at 6 p.m. Just after it had gone dark, and everybody would get ready. You know, we had 37 radio mics that everybody had to get on, and costumes and all that kind of stuff. And you know, everybody was in the same space at the same time. And this is in March 2020. I'm not sure whether you know what was going on in March 2020.
It eludes me. I have no idea.
But you know, it basically messed us up big time. Mm. But you know, without going too far into the story, basically what happened was, after the first night, we'd shot it twice and we were happy with it and it was good, you know, but we're like, look, we've got 6 more goes at this. We're going to get the one take that we want. You know what I mean? We're going to get the one, which is going to be perfect in every way. So then the producers called me really late that night, and we've been watching the news, and you know, the COVID was sort of like this dark cloud that was looming over everybody. And, you know, we like I said, we were over 150 people in one space at one time, and nobody was, you know, nobody told us to wear masks or anything like that. It was not, you know, it was literally just wash your hands. Yeah, wash your hands. That was it. And we were all hugging each other every time we come in, because we were a family. You know, we were a big family. And so the producers called me late on the Monday night and sort of said, look, tomorrow is going to have to be our last day because I think the whole country is going to go into lockdown the following day or the day after. So we were like, oh my gosh. So I literally I had to deal with that. And so coming in the next day, it was, you know, all systems go. I tried to put it to the back of my mind and just try and, you know, not tell the actors. I didn't tell the actors because I didn't want them to worry. So then we did it the first time. We did the first take on the second night. And then we were like, that was great. Performances were phenomenal. But there was a few technical things that I wasn't happy with. So I gave some notes to everybody. And then we were like, okay. And then I had to tell them then that this is going to be the last one. And I thought it was going to rile them up and, you know, make them be. But actually, it did the opposite. I think it was made them incredibly nervous, and actually the performances were quite flat, but technically it was flawless. So then we all got locked down and it was like, I need to choose between these two takes. So I watched them both again after like a week's break, just to, you know, breathe and figure out what the hell I just done. So then I decided to use the third take because I knew that we could fix any of the technical issues. Like there were small things. Like one of the things was the clock in the kitchen was an hour slow for some reason. So the hands were at the wrong time. So I was like, no, the restaurant's not going to be open at 4 o'clock. It's not going to be dark at 4 o'clock. People aren't going to be this busy at 4 o'clock. So we need to change it to at least 5 o'clock. So that was an expensive fix, really. Nobody will ever notice, ever notice. I mean, I did an incredible job. And then, you know, the other things were like a couple, like shadows, camera shadows on things and reflections of the camera in certain points, a couple of like just little shudders of the camera. But we were able to fix everything in post. We were able to, you know, to use some VFX and get rid of the shadows and certainly the reflections. Like for example, there's one which I was so impressed by when we go into the ladies' toilet with the manager, and she stood at the mirror. If you look to the right, there's a hand dryer, and it's completely chrome, and you could literally see the camera and Matt in the reflection. And I was like, I mean, what? Because on the other takes, he'd move slightly, so his reflection wasn't in it. But in this one, he for some reason something happened. He couldn't get around. So I was like, oh, you know, we have to. So, but again, they did an incredible job and fixed it all. And so for me, you know, it's always got to be performance over the technical side of it, because A, because of my acting background, and B, I think if an audience is not watching the performance and is not feeling the emotions and going through that emotions, and they're watching the technical thing, I know there'll be people out there who will watch the technical thing of it, but I feel like you've lost the audience if the performances aren't on point. That's my feeling anyway. So we went with the third take. Sure. Yeah.
Third take. That was the third take that you pulled this miracle off. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know, man. I know.
Was there ever a time you regretted doing this in one take?
Yeah, during.
Sure. So you didn't have you didn't even have one moment where you started and then had to stop.
No, honestly, it was apart from the, you know, we did the rehearsals. We did 3 weeks rehearsals. I did 3 weeks rehearsal with Matt, the camera operator, and we rehearsed the camera moves first. And then we had the actors for 3 weeks as well. And, you know, we did it stop, start, and that's how we sort of built it in layers. So we'd do the first, because the script was, there was no scene numbers or scenes in the script. It was all just, you know, movements. We call them movements or camera movements or beats. So the first beat would be, you know, Stephen walking into the restaurant and then going off to get changed. So we do that moment, and then we go back to the beginning, and we do the one and two, and then go back to the beginning, one, two, three, and we built it that way so that not only is the camera getting the moves down with the actors in place, but also the actors are you know, knowing what they need to say and at what points. And it's like muscle memory. So then when we get to the end, we all collapsed basically, after the rehearsals. And then it was a case of going through it. Then I think we rehearsed it in its entirety, maybe 4 times. And then, and I said to the actors from the start, I said, look, you know, if you mess up, unless it's an emergency, a medical emergency, or, you know, you cut yourself, or you slip over and break your leg. I mean, don't even stop then, because like, that's great drama, right? People are going to love it.
You'll work it in. You'll figure it out.
We'll call a real ambulance and we'll use it. You know, so I just said,
so that woman did have an allergic reaction.
She did, yeah. She did.
That was
speaking of this, I have to say, this is the first time that the words Chekhov's nut came into my head. Because you didn't know what, and that's the whole point of the Chekhov's gun type of thing.
Yeah.
You didn't know when it was going to come up, but you knew it was going to come up as soon as we hear nut allergy. And I love the way that you worked it in, and it became such a dramatic outpouring. It's such a climactic moment where everything's going crazy on screen. It affects all the characters. It affects all the relationships with the characters. And I think you scripted that just perfectly to come up at the right time. And I'm telling you, Chekhov's nut. That's the way to go.
Yeah.
You've set a new trend.
Chekhov's nut. I love it. As long as it's not plural.
Yeah. Well, of course.
Yeah.
But it was it was beautifully done. I have to also say, the health inspector at the beginning. Is it Mr. Lovejoy?
That's right. Yeah.
Thomas Coombs.
I
don't want to. I hesitate to say to any filmmaker that somebody steals a film or anything like that. But I mean, he absolutely just owns that first scene. I mean, he helps really get you into that whole mentality, because he's not taking any bullshit. But he's also being polite, and he's also got, you know, a previous relationship with the pastry chef.
Yep.
And what was that how you envisioned it on the page and it just came to life? Or was that just kind of like a performance that elevated everything?
Well, a bit of both, really. Yeah. I mean, I knew the character that I wanted, because I'd seen those characters, because that's what they're like. You know, they come in, they're such jobs worth, and you can't really crack them. They're just there to do the job, and they're just mad human beings. I don't know how they even get into that job. It's just crazy, but they're so passionate about it. And so I knew I wanted someone like that. And Stephen actually worked with Tommy Coombs on something before, and he's just like, I've got the perfect person for that role. And as soon as I met Tommy, I was like, oh yeah, he's great.
You felt like that guy had dealt with a health inspector before, because that was pretty dead on.
Well, he did actually. Yeah, I did actually send him out because where we shot it in it's a place in East London called called Hackney, and Hackney Council. They have their own health inspectors in every council. And so we got in touch with Hackney Council and said, look, could we possibly, we told them the situation and we were doing this movie. And they were like, I thought they would say no, because no one's allowed to be in the space and stuff like that. But they were like, oh no, yeah, of course he can come down. So actually Tommy went on a health inspection with this guy for the whole day. He went on about 6 or 7, I think he went to various different places. So, and the guy was exactly the character. I mean, it was honestly, I almost cast him. I almost said, like, can you act? You know, sorry Tommy, you've lost a job, mate.
Oh my god, when he finally, because you see the breadth of everything, like you see a little bit of playfulness with the person that he already knows, and then you see the down to work type of ability. And then you see, I guess, and again, you know, us Yankees, I'm sure it's more polite in the UK than it is over here. Over here, it's more like Donald Sutherland's character in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where he's just a, kind of a prick to everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
But at least here, he's a polite prick. But then when he sits down with Andy and those little distractions of, do I have your attention? Can I have your attention? Oh my God! It absolutely
and then he drops the knife.
Yeah, exactly. It's just absolutely gorgeous. I love that you started the film out like that.
Yeah.
Instead of just kind of squeezing that in somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it set it like you say. It does set the tone of like the whole place is on the back foot straight away from the beginning of the service, you know. And there's nothing worse than being on the back foot when you're about to go into the busiest service of the night, of the year, in fact. Yeah.
I kept wondering, like, how much stress are all of these people on? I mean, like I guess they're working at, you know, a somewhat newish, high class restaurant. And they're all working. Like, are all of these people just overworked and then try to party too hard afterwards? Or, you know, it's the amount of stress that are on all these people. Like there's people who are just on the verge of a nervous breakdown. There's people who are, you know, Stephen Graham, there's a point where he just goes into his office and, you know, there's office cocaine there for him to
oh yeah.
And you know, you see somebody with self-cutting and all this. It's is this something that's I guess I could be answering my own question here, but is this more of an everyday life? You can find this in any workplace, or do restaurants have a high level of these, like, people who are like just spending, like, don't seem to have any time, just are always constantly working and don't have chance to visit loved ones and all this and that kind of thing? Is that something that's normal at a restaurant?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's actually getting better now in terms of, especially in this country, in the UK, it's getting better in terms of, like, there's help out there for people who are stressed and, you know, going through, the addictions and everything that people are going through. There's a lot more help out there and people are reaching out more, but yeah, certainly it's a really high pressured environment, and you know, you've got to be on the same level as everybody else. Otherwise, if there's a 1 week link, then you just get fired, you know, you're just gone and it's on to the next person. So it is really stressful. And yeah, people do party too hard, you know, because at the end of the day, when you finished your service, let's say 10, 11 PM at night or whatever, maybe later, your mindset, certainly for me anyway, my mindset was always like, I deserve a drink now. I deserve to party because I've been busy working and everybody else who's at the front, you know, the customers have been having a great time. Now it's my time to have a great time. And, you know, sometimes to the detriment of my family and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it does relate to a lot of high pressure jobs. And in fact, people have said it to me before, you know, they watch the movie and they're in banking and they said it's exactly the same. I had the same anxiety watching the movie that I had when I worked in a bank, you know. So but you know, there is help out there now for all of that, you know, for the stresses and the mental health and things.
I mean, I could go on all this for all day. I mean, this is really, between, you know, the subject matter, the performances, the technical agility that you showed. And I have to say one more thing before Sophia comes through the screen and shows.
Sure. No, don't worry. Honestly, say, go for it. Go for it.
The fact that everyone in this, every character in this is treated with some sort of empathy really impacted me.
Mm-hmm,
The fact that, and people, whoever's listening to this, when you go to a restaurant, I hope you watch this film and see from the other perspective what people go through, not only your servers, not only the bar staff, but, you know, the prep staff and the you know, all that stuff, the dishwashers, all the stuff that everybody goes through. Nobody, like I said, nobody's perfect in this film, right? Like everybody's got kind of their I'm not going to do a roll credits boiling point, but everybody's got their tipping point. But not that I don't love the title, but like, I do appreciate that you treated everyone from the newest employee on to, you know, the head chef with the same amount of empathy. They're all humans. They're all in a family. They're all trying their best.
Yeah.
In this environment. I think that's what rang the truest to me, even though there's so much to love about all the stuff that you did. And I really appreciate the way that you handled these characters.
That means the world, honestly. Thank you so much. Because that's exactly what we set out to do, you know, to bring the truth to these characters, and also, you know, bring to life people that I've worked with or come across in my life, you know, because they always say write about what you know, right? And also these characters are based on people that I know or have seen or come into contact with. So yeah, it really means that a lot that that comes across, you know, and I appreciate that. Yeah.
I can't wait for you to do more films. This is going to be fun. Me too. To watch
too. All right, Philip, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much, guys. It's been a pleasure. It really has.
The movie is Boiling Point. It comes out in theaters November 19th and digital and on demand November 23rd. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson, Jonathan Watkins, and Barrett Scherer. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.